Welcome to Music in a New World, a series of half-hour programs which explore the music of ethnic communities across America. Your host for these programs is ethnomusicologist Carl Signell.
Russian music is something most of us grew up with, at least certain kinds of Russian music. We learned Russian songs in school, usually from the cabaret gypsy repertoire. We hear those incredibly low vocal tones from that basso profundo priest in the Eisenstein movie, and we know Russian folk and church music as filtered through the art of Mussorgsky and Stravinsky. Russian immigrants to America keep these and other musical traditions in a more complex and varied way. Russian music, especially music of the Orthodox Church, is at the core of the ethnic identity for many Russians in the U.S. On this program, we'll attend an extraordinary liturgy in New York. We'll hear a rare set of church bells in San Francisco, and we'll chat with a balalaika virtuoso in Southern California. The three waves of Russian immigration can be fairly represented by these selections.
It reminds me my beautiful, my incredible, my dream, my favorite Leningrad.
Misha Shenkman came to America with the current influx of Russians, the third wave. He says he has a mission in America.
Here, I think I have some kind of mission. I would like to destroy the image of Russian folk music in American mind, because Americans, they know Russian folk music, I think, very stereotypically. In Russia, Russian music, it's more than Kalinka, Ochi Chorny, Dark Eyes, or something else. It's more. It's the biggest, I'll say, it's the biggest mountain of music, you know.
For example, what?
It's a many music. I can play, you know, this is very interesting Russian song called «Заиграй моя волынка», or «Play my bagpipe».
After Misha came to this country, he composed a nostalgic song with a village atmosphere.
The atmosphere, the typical Russian summer evening in a village, you know, in a Russian village, and somebody play balalaika and the cows, you know, and far away the man like this, you know, and so, such a warm weather. My English is a little bit poor to explain, but thank you. But you know, every Russian, of course, you will understand me. ла-ри-ра-ра.
Are you Jewish? Are you Russian? Are you American?
Yeah, well, this is a very difficult question. I am typical product of Soviet assimilation politics, you know. And by blood, I am Jewish, of course, but by my culture, my language, my feeling, my expression about Russia, about, you know, I am, of course, I'm Russian.
You and have to figure out in what way you're going to fit in America.
Yes. I want to be American. My first impression was when I came to the United States, it was the 21st of December, 1978. Mm-hmm. And the 22nd of December, I go to the market. And when I came to the cashier, you know, and she says to me, "Thank you." I said, "Oh, my goodness." I said to myself, "Why you?" But some part of the, yes, because, you know, you all the time feel in Russia you are such a small flea, you know, fly. Yes, absolutely. And because, yes, because the people who make a service like a waiters or in a post office, yeah, or a bureaucrats, they, you know, they see you, who are you? You know, you are such a small things, you know. This is the
and that's why you left Russia?
No, of course not. The big reasons I would like to save a future for my sons.
Balalaika virtuoso from Leningrad, Misha Schenkman. He coaches the Odessa Balalaika Ensemble and teaches privately in San Pedro, California. Misha represents the third wave of immigrants, mostly Jewish, still arriving from the Soviet Union. The second wave came after World War II and was mostly Christian. They often took over churches left by earlier Russians. One of the first Russian Orthodox churches in America was built in San Francisco. In 1888, the Russian Tsar gave to that church a set of bells. The set is probably unique in the U.S. The largest bell weighs 6,000 pounds.
As I understand it, there are only two or three Orthodox churches in the country with large sets of bells. Many Orthodox churches have one bell or two or maybe three, but to have more than three is unusual. Yes. There's a kind of a wonderful story about the bells. As Father Seraphim mentioned, this present church was built after the earthquake and fire in 1906. And the bells survived the fire and earthquake in an almost miraculous way, just a few weeks before the earthquake and the fire. They had taken the bells out of the tower to do some reinforcement on the bell tower at the old church. And the bells were conveniently sitting on the back of a wagon, and they were able to take the bells south of Market, where the fire, out of the range of the fire, and that's the only reason we have them today. We would have lost them for sure otherwise. I'm Stephen Robbins, and I'm one of the bell ringers.
Can you tell me how you got started in this bell ringing business?
My bell ringing experience goes way back. When I was a small child, my parents had boarders who lived in the basement who were bell ringers. They would occasionally give me the great treat of riding up and down on the bell rope for the biggest bell, which I was small enough to ride.
You'd grab hold of the bell and go right up in the air.
Yeah, they would get it going and hold me up and let me grab it, and I'd ride it up to the ceiling and come back. And that was the beginning of a lifelong infatuation with bells.
Father Seraphim, how did you get started in this?
I was trained by two old Russian ringers, but the church where I grew up only had three bells, so they were
Can't
sort
do
of limited.
Too exciting.
No, it was very limited. But what they would do is hang additional ropes, mm-hmm. from the pillars.
And you use your imagination.
And you use your imagination and swack the rope. But
and this was in America or in...
This was in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. Were you born in this country or...
No, I immigrated with my parents after World War II, 1950.
In the...
That was the second wave, the displaced person immigration. Yeah.
I ring the two smallest bells, usually, and I will usually set up a rhythmic pattern, which usually sets the speed that we're going to operate at. And the other bell ringers will join in, basically taking the same tempo that I have, but with their own rhythms.
The bells, for instance, have always been meant for those who could not come to church, who were at home, who were sick, who had a trade that did not permit them to partake of the worship service, to remain where they are and still hear and understand, aha, the bell is ringing, that means this is happening now. A different sound, now this is happening. And you could follow the progress of the service by the bells.
The most important surviving example of that would be the fact that we toll the large bell during the reading of the creed, which is right before the actual consecration and the communion of the people, and this indicates to the man on the street, okay, this particularly solemn moment is happening. Thank you.
Let's describe a service.
One word comes to mind: overwhelming. You know, because there, the sense of there is so much color, and all of your senses are being stimulated. Essentially, the smell of incense, the smell of candle wax, because there are lots of candles. The music, which is glorious. The sound of the bells, the movement of the people, the richness of the vestments.
Yeah, the main thrust in an Orthodox service is to incorporate the total individual into the worship of God. Not just the mind, just the eyes, just the hearing, but everything together simultaneously.
The heart?
The heart also. Mm, yes. Absolutely.
Father Seraphim Gizetti, Dean of the Holy Trinity Russian Orthodox Cathedral of San Francisco. He came to America with the second wave of Russian immigrants. In New York City, I went to a Russian Orthodox service where my senses were overwhelmed, as Steve and Father Seraphim described it. The liturgy was perhaps the most extraordinary since the Revolution, the canonization of 8,000 martyrs. The church was packed with a congregation of more than 1,000, many obviously first-wave immigrants from after World War I. Father Viktor Potapov is my guide.
Now he's saying, let us again pray for the repose of the souls of the servants of God. And then he mentions many of the names. They had, I think, 8,000 names.
What is it the chorus is singing?
The chorus is singing right now, Lord have mercy.
And they just repeat that?
They just repeat
over and over?
It, yeah, to sort of cut into the monotony of the reading of the names. And also it gives it a prayerful atmosphere. I might mention that in the Orthodox Church, the prayer, Kyrie eleison, Gospodi pomiluj, or Lord have mercy, is one of the shortest and one of the most complete prayers.
Much later, in a service which lasted more than 3 hours, the seminary choir sang with exceptional feeling. Now here, the seminary choir sounds, it sounds very Russian. What are they feeling that makes them sing that way?
This is a very, very... You know, the words are very powerful, the simple melody is a very powerful one. With the saints, give rest, O Lord, to the souls of their departed servants, in a place of verdure, a place of refreshment, where there is no sighing, no crying, but only joy in being in your countenance. That particular piece was sung at the very beginning of the movie Dr. Zhivago.
Thank you.
happening here. The choir started and suddenly everyone is singing.
Everyone, yeah.
What is this?
Well, this is the last prayer of the memorial service. In translation, it's Eternal Memory, Vechnaya Pamyat in Slavonic. And
it's a very powerful moment. I feel that the entire thousand people in this church are singing.
The reason it is because this is the last memorial service for the martyrs. After this time, the church forbids us to serve memorial service to the martyrs.
They're singing it again, the same thing again?
The clergy is picking it up now. And also the congregation comes in. The same prayer. Usually, at memorial services, this prayer is only sung once, but because of the fervor of the spiritual feeling, everybody wanted to sing it three times in honor of the Holy Trinity.
What are the words?
Just two words, eternal memory.
You'd have to have a heart of stone not to be moved.
Many of the people present suffered through what many of the martyrs suffered through. Many of the people's relatives were killed, maybe several of the people were present. Some of their relatives were canonized as well. That's one of the reasons I think that so much feeling was put into the singing.
Ибо снег владыка державу твою разруши. Воскресни, Господи, Боже мой, да вознесется рука твоя, не забудь ее, Боги твоих до конца. Плотью смерти впусти, Господи, горе смерти пресекались, и восстанем твоими человека на нее укрепились. Впервые клятвы и одоление призывая защиты чести нашей Господи.
The whole service is structured in a way as to draw in all the senses.
Exactly.
You've got the gorgeous robes and crowns of the bishops, the censers with the smoke and the smell. And
exactly. You know, the reason for that is that in the Orthodox Church we feel that during prayer all of man's nature should be involved in prayer. Not only his soul, but his body as well. For example, the incense, the rising of incense, shows the people in a mystical way that our prayers should rise as the smoke of the censer rises to heaven. Also that our prayers should have a sweet fragrance as the incense has. Candles burning mystically symbolize our souls, which also should be burning in prayer. The cupolas of Orthodox churches are formed onion-shaped domes, and what that means is like the flame of a candle. And the flame of a church is the cupola, which represents the prayers, the corporate prayers of all the faithful together in church at the same time, praying to God. All these things give the faithful a sense that being in church, you're in a different world.
Canonization of the new martyrs. His Eminence Metropolitan Filaret presiding. The religious fervor of the congregation and the sensory impact of the liturgy was unforgettable. Playing the balalaika, Misha Shenkman, a recent immigrant from Russia. If you'd like to comment on these programs, drop a line to Music in a New World, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. Again, Music in a New World, National Public Radio, Washington, D.C., 20036. The consulting producer for this series is Deb Lamberton. The Center for American Folklife kindly loaned the professional equipment for the field recordings. I'd like to thank those whose music contributed to this program: Misha Schenkman, Steve Robbins, Father Seraphim. Special thanks to Holy Trinity Cathedral in San Francisco, and to Bishop Gregory in New York, and the Synod of Bishops of the Russian Orthodox Church in Exile. Father Viktor Potapov generously helped with the liturgical segment. Audio engineering by Mary Ishnaga, Leszek Wójcik, and Chuck Thompson. I'm your host and producer, Carl Signell. Thanks for listening, and won't you join me for the next edition of Music in a New World?
You've been listening to Music in a New World, a series of programs exploring ethnic music in communities across America. The production of this program was made possible through a grant from the Folk Arts Program of the National Endowment for the Arts and with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.